Welcome to Blog Talk Radio.
Where
we're discussing sublime topics like Tar Heels versus Duke. You know, that's it. If got into Tar Heels, then why is the sky Carolina blue? So, friends, tonight we're going to be talking about something that is, to me, an absolutely fascinating and truly important topic, and that is the spirituality of authority. And we live in a world where authority has an almost negative connotation. When we think about authority, what are the words that we associate with authority? All right. Police.
Dictator.
Dictatorial. Okay. Bureaucracy. You know, all these negatives. And when we think about the opposite of authority, what do we think about? Freedom. Okay, liberty, freedom of conscience, you know, live your own life, be yourself. All right. So that's, we're still trapped in the 60s is what's going on here, okay? All right, this is still Woodstock, okay? And as much as I liked Woodstock, I was driving to college when Woodstock was happening, and I came to the New York State Thruway, and it was like, college this way, Woodstock that way, so I made the choice to go to college, right? But then I had two guys in my fraternity that when the Woodstock movie came out, they were like on the poster for the Woodstock movie right in front. Two of them were there. Those are guys in my fraternity. So it was like, I could have been there. Okay. So anyway, getting back to business here. If you look at the handout that I passed out, this is from Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, the great conservative religious thinker. The greatest theologian of the conservative movement. As a tree torn from the soil, as a river separated from its source, the human soul wanes when detached from what is greater than itself. Without the holy, the good turns chaotic. Without the good, beauty becomes accidental. Okay. Now, if the soul wanes when detached from what is greater than itself, and if we are unwilling to admit that there is anything greater than ourselves, what's the consequence? The consequence is that we are dooming ourselves to deterioration. The arrogance of autonomy. When we imagine ourselves to be the pinnacle of creation, separated not just from like earthworms, but separated from God, we doom ourselves to a life of spiritual emptiness. And living in the 21st century and living in America, this is a serious problem for us. I mean, remember, what was the first motto of the United States before they got to E Pluribus Unum? What was on a lot of the state flags?
Live free or die.
Oh, live free or die, right, good. Good, live free or die. And don't tread on me, all right? Don't tread on me, you know. I'm my own man. Don't tread on me. Which is a perfectly reasonable thing to say when you're talking about a king who lives 3,000 miles away on the other side of the planet. Yeah, okay, but this is metastasized so that we look at God and say, don't tread on me. I'm my own man. Which, if you look at the arc of our lives, it seems like a very silly statement, but even ignoring that, just the whole pretense that we are somehow totally autonomous from God and that God has no right to, so to speak, tread on us, is an utterly perverse way of looking at things and prevents us from any kind of spiritual development. This manifests itself in a lot of ways. We'll start with the issue of morality. I once had the experience, when I was in Savannah, we had a joint conservative reform Hebrew school. So I was spending time down at the Reform Synagogue, and it happened that I was there while they were having like a study breakfast, And the rabbi was a wonderful guy, Rabbi Arnie Belzer, wonderful guy. He was talking about an article that had come out in Reform Judaism magazine, where the a rabbi, I think it was Rabbi Richard Hirsch, who was the, sort of the head of the rabbinical association of the Reform movement, had written an article saying, pointing out that it was that there were certain Reform Jews that had found spiritual satisfaction in doing things like keeping kosher or going to the mikveh, and that even though you couldn't mandate that for everybody, that the Reform movement should be broad enough to recognize that these are legitimate spiritual paths and so forth. So Rabbi Belzer, my friend and colleague, he says, you know, I can understand the Reform movement not being willing to mandate that everybody goes to the mikveh or everybody keeps kosher. Okay, but wouldn't it be legitimate to mandate that people don't do Lashon Hara, or that people should, you know, give money to tzedakah? Right. Immediately, eight hands shoot up. And the common theme from all of them are, who are you to tell me what to do? And I'm sitting there and I'm watching this, and I'm saying to myself, who are you to tell me what to do? I mean, first of all, the guy has read, I don't know, 10,000 Jewish books. You know, if 100 books make you an expert, he's an expert, you know, 100 times over. Isn't that enough for him to be able to, you know, for him to tell you what to do? But the bigger question is not just him, but what he represents, right? Because they weren't just saying, you have no right to tell me what to do. They were saying, God has no right to tell me what to do. Right? Nobody tells me anything. I'm my own man. And I submit to you that that is an utterly perverse but completely common self-perception in modernity in general and in Judaism in particular. So with that in mind, I want you to take a look at the next pages in our handout here. This is the introduction to an interview with Aidan Steinsaltz, who you might recognize the name. He is the guy who was responsible for doing a translation of a modern translation of the Talmud. That's like this incredibly useful. I mean, when I was going to rabbinical school, this guy was like God. He was like this, you know, it was the Talmud with punctuation marks and explanatory comments, and it was like, oh God, this is so easy compared to, you know, trying to learn it without. But he, besides being a, you know, a Talmudic master, he also, you know, is a theologian and a deep thinker. So, in the people who are going to interview him, about whom I know nothing, by the way, the people who are going to interview him write the following introduction. Whether we are aware of it or not, levels of authority everywhere govern the course of our lives. Bosses oversee our places of work. Guardians of the law enforce civil order. Red lights and green regulate the public bustle in our streets. Within us, mysterious stops and starts curb and give rein to jostling mitochondria and avid enzymes in the spaces of our cells. Moral codes weigh heavily on us all, good and bad alike. We are plagued by the hierarchical demands of our conditioned ethical imperatives. Yet confronted as we are on every hand by its impact, the hierarchical principle has in our time a bad name, and tends to be denied, discounted, ignored. The fault may lie with hierarchies of doubtful authenticity, such as those imposed by political knavery. But even legitimate ones are uncongenial to those living in an age bemused by the dream of equality, freedom, and the importance of me. To be sure, those in search of spiritual understanding are primarily concerned with the essential truth and the way to it. Whatever their attitude towards hierarchy, they may find that what is required of them first off is obedience, and moreover, the only obedience worthy of its name, that which is voluntary. When rebellious nuns and monks jump over the wall, it is rarely the rigors of poverty or sexual deprivation that motivate them. Resistance to authority is far more likely to be the root of the trouble. Be that as it may, the fact is that the interstices of our lives are laced with subtle skeins of authority. A maze of hidden hierarchies exert their inevitable impact on our comings and goings. And then they go on to explain that's why they wanted to talk to Aidan Steinfeld about this. Okay. So if you want to talk about religiosity and or spirituality and authority, the first thing they have to do is recognize that there is authority and that there is hierarchy, and we're not at the top of it. Because if we already are at the top of it, what are we doing here? Right? The fact that we need to do any kind of spiritual search at all is an indication of the fact that we're not at the top of the ladder. We have some place to go. We have something to do. We have something to learn. So this is taken from a magazine called Parabola. So they list the first question to Aidan Steinfeld. We live in an egalitarian moment in which it is considered that everyone is equal and everyone is free, and the idea of hierarchy is perceived as an arbitrary imposition on the freedom of man. I wonder how realistic this conception is from your point of view. Aidan Steinfeld. My point of view is almost the opposite. Okay, egalitarian ideas are not supported by any evidence. Okay, so keeping a real long story short, and we'll stop there. You know, you're welcome to read the rest of that at your leisure. But keeping it real simple, you know, I don't care how equal we all are, I ain't Einstein. Yeah, sorry. You know, and anybody who says that I am is really wrong. And if I think that I am, then I'm really nuts. Okay. Now, it may be that both Einstein and I should both have one vote when it comes to a political election. Okay. And because he's Einstein, that doesn't necessarily make him smarter in politics than I am. Okay. And it certainly doesn't make him a better husband to my wife than I am. Okay. But to say that, oh yeah, well, we're all equal, is simply a foolish statement. Right? There's no reality to it. All right. Understanding that helps us to understand the statement in the Psalms that really matters here. Reshit chokhma yirat Hashem. The beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord, or the awe of the Lord. The first step towards wisdom is having a relationship of awe toward God, where you aren't equals, you aren't buddies, you aren't pals, you aren't homies. There is a connection, there is a relationship. All right? But do not kid yourself. There is a concept in the Talmud, a wonderful concept, called chavruta klape alma. And that means treating God like a pal. And even though the rabbis in the Talmud often have these sort of positive relationships with God, sort of intimate relationships with God, you're still not allowed to treat God like a pal. Yeah. And just one small comparison, not manifestation, God forbid, but comparison to that, is that people calling me rabbi. You know, there are some people that are inclined to call me Robert. And in some context, you know, that would be an okay thing. But not when I'm wearing the stripes. You know, and not because, oh, you have to call me rabbi. It's because I'm a rabbi. You know, and that has a particular meaning. All right? It means I am the one that has carried this burden of tradition, and that's what I do, and that needs to be respected for what it is. You know, hopefully I'm not like making too big a deal about that. You know, I don't demand like front seats in the theater because I'm the rabbi, although there was a rabbi in Stockholm who's coming to a restaurant or something, and he said that he was Rabbi so-and-so, and they said, well, what's that? And he said, oh, that's the Jewish equivalent of a bishop. And they said, oh, and they put him in, they put him like in the front seat or something. You know, it's a slick move. All right. But, but it's not. It has nothing to do with me or my status. It has to do with the status of our tradition. So that's why I'm sort of insistent on that. You know, whereas in other contexts I might not be. Okay. So first, I want to talk about the moral considerations of what happens if you do not have a reverence for authority. And it goes back to Ivan Karamazov and the brothers Karamazov and Dostoevsky. If there is no God, all is permitted. If there is no God, all is permitted. Because if you think about it, whatever rationale I can come up with for any kind of moral statement, you know, don't kill people, somebody else could come up with a rationale that would make it like a perfectly appropriate thing to do. We just saw that writ large in Paris. And however much I can get up and say, oh, this is horrible and this is immoral and how can you do this, ISIS or Al-Qaeda in Yemen or whoever it is will come and say, no, this is a perfectly moral thing. These are heroes. They're martyrs. They did this wonderful thing, killing children. Great heroes. Bertrand Russell, who himself was an atheist, he grappled with this problem his whole life. And he said, I cannot see, and I'm quoting him, I cannot see how to refute the arguments for the subjectivity of ethical values. All right. He's saying subjectivity of ethical values means that there's not like this absolute thing that murder is wrong. All right. The value that murder is wrong, well, that's what you may think and that's what I may think, but it's kind of our personal internal decision to make that, to say that that murder is wrong. It's not like this divine mandate built into the universe. It's the way we feel about it. Okay? So Bertrand Russell says, I cannot see how to refute the arguments for the subjectivity of ethical values, but I find myself incapable of believing that all that is wrong with wanton cruelty is that I don't like it. Okay? I don't like it. You know, I don't think it was a good thing for Hitler to murder 6 million Jews. But Hitler thought it was a good thing to murder 6 million Jews, so I guess we're even. Because I don't like it. And he did like it. And who am I to say that he was wrong? You know, I think he was wrong. He thought he was right. 50-50, there you go. But of course, those words are repulsive. It's hard for me to even get them out of my mouth. Okay? So, you know, somebody pointed out, Oliver Martin, writing a book about education, Taka, he said that, you know, people will say, I believe in morals, but all morals are relative. Or, I have my own private moral code. Or, morals are entirely a matter of opinion. And Oliver Martin points out that Hitler could accept every single one of those statements. So when you think about how common those statements are, if you went into a high school right now and you asked kids about morality, assuming they would understand what you meant, all right, if you asked them about morality, I will guarantee you that's exactly what they would say. Okay, it's all relative. You look at it your way. But what Judaism believes, and this is essential for our understanding about our spiritual place in life, is that there is a God who mandates certain kinds of things and builds those things into the fabric of the universe. Think about the fact that God introduces himself in the Ten Commandments by saying, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Okay, I am God who frees slaves. That's what I do. Now, he could have said, I'm the creator of the universe. I'm going to whack you if you don't listen to me. He could have said a whole bunch of different things. Okay, I'll take care of you. Whatever. But God defines himself as the God who frees slaves. That is built into the fabric of the universe. It's not a nice idea. It's not a socioeconomic revolution. It's a divine mandate, right, that comes with the backed up by the authority of the creator of the universe. It drives me up a wall when people say, well, you know, you don't really have to believe in God to be Jewish, which is biologically true. Okay, that's right. If you're born to a Jewish mother, you're Jewish. You're in the tribe, Mazel Tov. But to make the link and say, and that somehow is legitimate within the context of Judaism, is utter nonsense. Right? It is utter nonsense. Now, that's not to point a finger at people who are atheists in our congregation, because I would assume that 20% of our congregation are atheist or agnostic. Okay? Or atheists without any guts. People, you can't make yourself believe something. Although you can explore it, but you can't make yourself believe. You can't, like, flip the switch. But to say, oh, you don't need God to have Judaism, it's just an utterly, it's like saying, you know, oh, you don't have to have English to have Shakespeare. Really? Yeah. No, I think you're probably wrong about that. So assuming that, as our tradition certainly does assume, that there is this divine authority, what is our relationship supposed to be with that divine authority? You know, what, as our spiritual life develops, how do we see ourselves in relationship with the divine? And the fundamental, our fundamental position in that regard is as being a servant of God, right? That we are, our life here is meant to be a life in divine service. All right. Being a servant of God means that I take my autonomous consciousness, you know, my free will, my choices, my desires, and what I do with them is to align them to the will of God. There is a beautiful joke that two Hasidic masters who were arguing about miracles. And one of them said, you know, you think it's a miracle if you can get God to do your will. I think it's a miracle if God could get me to do his will. Right. The miracle is getting us to conform our human consciousness with the will of God. I desire to unify my will with God's will within my own life and to delight in that unification. Rabbi Gamliel used to say, do God's will as if it were your will, so that he may do your will as if it were his will. You start out, you want me to do that again? Did that go by a little fast? Okay. Do God's will as if it were your will, that God may do your will as if it were his will. The servant of God seeks an alignment of what he or she wants with the divine will. And you submerge the personal will into the divine will, to which every modern person would go, what? You mean my will is not supreme? You mean what I want and what I think and what I've decided upon is not the ultimate decisor in reality? Right. It is not. It is not. I'm sorry? Yeah, obviously not, or Duke would not have lost the last two games. Right. Okay. That's right. God is living in North Carolina someplace in Chapel Hill. Okay. That's why they call it Chapel Hill. All right. So when you realize that you are supposed to be in divine service, what that means is that you then can look at all of your various actions and thoughts and speech and ideas and all the rest of that and ask yourself, how can I put those into divine service? All right. So one of my absolute favorite stories, for me, a life transformative story that I tell every chance I have, so you might have heard this before, but suffer. But bear with me, because it's a great story, is that there was a story of a rabbi who came from a little shtetl, and he moved to the big city. And when he came to the big city, he saw a guy sweeping the streets. So he went up to him, and he said, you know, what are you doing? And so he's a, you know, big city, cynical guy. He goes, what do you mean, what I'm doing? I'm sweeping the streets. And the rabbi said, well, who do you work for? And the street sweeper looked at him and said, yeah, who do you work for? And so the rabbi hired the guy to come to his house every day and knock on the door. And when the rabbi opened the door, he said, who do you work for? Right? every day we should have a reminder about who it is that we're working for. Okay? And it's not us. And it's not us. All right? And besides the idea that we have to, like, our thoughts and our actions and so forth have to be in divine service, we also have to, you know, think about the stuff that we want, the unsanctioned and unsanctified personal gratification, Alan Moranis calls it. Right? Unsanctified and unsanctioned personal gratification. You know, running around doing stuff that we know that we shouldn't be doing instead of devoting ourselves to the divine will. Right? The divine is much bigger and is much truer than anything that I personally could come up with to want. Okay? So my narrow self-interest, and I'm quoting here from Alan Moranis, who is the leader of the Musar Institute and my teacher, all right, that what is in our self-interest is minuscule compared to the interest of God, is minuscule and profoundly secondary to the interests of God. Now, one aspect of our spiritual development that makes that kind of alignment with God possible is having a sense of order. Having a sense of order. It is no coincidence that the prayer book that we use is called a Siddur. That comes from the word Seder, which is the Passover Seder, which means the order of what we are doing. All right. Again, order is one of those words that we much prefer chaos. At least we think we much prefer chaos. All right? Because it's like, I want to do what I want. I don't want to have to, you know, put the stuff away. I just want to take it out. Blah blah blah. All right? You know, every kid goes through this phase. All right? I saw a beautiful birthday card. Dahlia had her 8th birthday, so I'm looking for a birthday card. So one of the cards that I wanted to buy for her was a card that says, "May you have as many blessings as there are clothes on your floor." Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that marvelous? You know, you should have as many blessings as there are clothes on your floor. Okay, but okay. Yeah, yeah, right. Okay, so, but hopefully we outgrow that at some point. Hopefully, and it's an interesting thing when you read the Shulchan Aruch, you know, the great compendium of Jewish law. It starts with the word Yitgaber Kari Lamod Baboker Lasot Avodat Boro, that you should rise up like a lion with the strength of a lion every morning to do the will of your Creator, or do the work of your Creator. And one of the first things it then talks about is how you tie your shoes. And there's a set order to how you tie your shoes. What? What?
Rabbi, do you ever listen to JM in the AM?
No. JM in the AM? No.
Yeah, I think it's like 91.1.
Okay.
In the morning.
Yeah.
During drive time.
Uh-huh.
And it's this Jewish radio station.
Uh-huh.
And every Friday, Rabbi Yudin from Fairlawn.
Uh-huh, okay.
Gives a devar.
Uh-huh.
And I remember him talking about
this issue.
The time of the shoes and
okay.
First
okay. So I can tell you why it is that there's a mandate like this. But I'm not going to do that now. I'm not going to take the time. All right, if we have time later, I'll tell you later. I'll tell you over the cheesecake. All right. But that there is a halakha like this, your first reaction is, are you kidding me? I mean,
I'm not doing it wrong.
Yeah. Well, probably, how would you know? But I'll tell you how to do it right. But it's like, come on. I mean, okay, don't murder, don't steal. I get it. How to tie my shoes? God's going to get involved with this? You know, lightning bolt strikes if I put on the right shoe instead of the left shoe? Come on. Who could care about this? Why? Why does it matter? Okay? But I'll tell you, I understand, having kids, I understand this now better than I ever did before. When I see my kids get out of the car and walk towards the school door with their shoelaces untied as they're walking in. Yeah, all right. After I've told them 500 times to tie their shoes, right? The fact that there is this disorder is a reflection of the fact that there's not a concern for order. And if there's not a concern for order, that means that you are living in a world of chaos. And if you are living in a world of chaos, there's not the slightest chance that you're going to be able to align your will with the will of the Creator, because your will is going to be all over the place. It's going to be bouncing around like a ping pong ball. There's no sense of, like, direction. There's no sense of, like, oh, well, this is where I'm going and I have to make this adjustment. That requires, like, thought. That requires awareness. And when, if people are just going to sort of, like, run around and do stuff without attempting to find any kind of order in what they're doing, you know, taking their free will and saying, I can go and do anything I want. All right? To choose to be chaotic like that, all right, is, you know, yeah, we have free will, but, you know, you're choosing to squander it, all right? But when we make a conscious practice of being orderly, all right, when we say, okay, we got to get a direction here, all right, and I'm going to try and get involved in this project of getting my will to match the will of the Creator, can you see how systematic you have to be to do that? You know, it's like doing the analogy I would draw is like if you try and do Shabbos, right? You could look at Shabbos and say, "Oh God, Rabbi, you got rules. You can't touch this, and you can't do that, and you can't go over here, and you can't spend money, and you can't right, you can't. All these thou shalt not. You're driving me nuts here. I want to have like Shabbos. I just want to have this beautiful spiritual experience." But when you live it, what you realize is that if you don't set up those boundaries so that you can't spend money and you can't travel all over the place and you can't work at your job and you can't, you know, do the garden or move the furniture or do this other stuff, because until you set up those boundaries, you're going to get trapped in doing all this other stuff and you will not experience Shabbos. Right? This is a case of the law liberating, not entrapping us. All right? What we do with Shabbat and try and set up this order so that we could have this experience, that is a parallel to what we're supposed to be doing internally and setting up the order of our lives and the boundaries of our lives so that we can direct ourselves towards aligning our will with the will of our Creator. All right? And when we do that, all right, we get closer to God. It creates the possibility of closeness to God. And when we experience that sense of closeness to God, the next thing that comes in is another one of those virtues that, like, nobody wants to call a virtue. And that's the virtue of humility. That's the virtue of humility. All right? We tend to associate humility with humiliation. Okay. We think that if you are humble, that you're going to get taken. Right. You got to get your elbows out. You got to stand up for yourself. Don't let anybody give you grief. Man up. Be tough. Show them who you are. We are somebody. Yeah, we are somebody who like needs like a lot of work. All right. See, and that's what I would, you know, that would be a wonderful message. Remember when Jesse Jackson would go around, you know, you are somebody. Well, yeah, you're somebody who comes from a broken home, has no prospects, is surrounded by high crime. Yeah, you are somebody. And if you really want to do something with your life, then you better start doing A, B, and C. Right? That would have been a great message. But no, you are somebody. You're just fine the way you are. Don't do anything. Don't strive for anything. You're great. You don't need humility. That would be humiliating for you to seek humility. Better that you should just have self-esteem. Now, that's the important thing. A self-esteem based on an ignorance and a misperception of who you are. It's an utterly perverse message. Humility is the extreme awareness of one's own limits. Right. It is the virtue that belongs to the person who realizes that they are not God. And that is like, you know, our modern age is almost the hardest recognition that any of us have. Right? Remember what the guys on Wall Street used to call themselves before the big crash. Remember what the, how they described themselves, like the really, you know, billionaire players. Right? Remember the term they called themselves? Masters of the universe. Okay. Yeah. Guess what? Didn't quite work out, did it? Okay. You know, they got bailed out by, you know, all the people that they, you know, have contempt for because they have food, they use food stamps. All right. Anyone who truly believes he is divine, master of the universe, either knows nothing about God, right, or doesn't know themselves. Being humble means recognizing the truth and submitting to it. Recognizing the truth and submitting to it. Now, that may seem like the most obvious and reasonable thing to do. Well, it's the truth. You recognize it. End of story. Welcome to the world of pulpit rabbis. All right? Because pulpit rabbis, every pulpit rabbi has a dance to do about whether or not they're allowed to tell their congregation the truth. Okay? It's particularly acute within Reform congregations, you know, that have such an astronomical intermarriage rate, where you almost cannot get up and say intermarriage is not a good thing. Right? What do you mean? I have a good one. Yeah. As if that's the end of the discussion, because of course the whole world centers around you, and since you have a good one, that's, we're all good to go, right? Wrong. But sometimes the truth can be really, really painful truths. And you would think that people would go out of their way to say, tell me the truth, because knowing the truth, you know, the truth will set you free, right? That's not actually ours, but okay, but we'll take it. All right. Knowing the truth, that's a good thing, isn't it? Well, not exactly. All right, remember Ibsen's fabulous play, Enemy of the People, all right, where sometimes, you know, a lot of people don't want to know the truth. I mean, it is an archetypal image. All right, you had Ibsen do it, but it's repeated in its own way in the movie Jaws, okay? And in every grade C horror movie made after Jaws, what always happens at the beginning of every one of those movies, okay? Step one, monster eats somebody. Step two, the mayor says, don't tell anybody. Right? I mean, come on. Every single one. Don't tell anybody. It's a tourist season, and this, you know, it's bad for business. Yeah, don't tell anybody. All right? Humility means loving the truth more than oneself. And that is a really, really hard thing for people to do, to get to the point of saying that the truth is more important than my own ego. Humility, thinking with humility, humble thought, is the opposite of vanity. Right? Humble thought, real thought, is the opposite of vanity, because vanity is not thought at all. Vanity is a form of belief, a belief in the self. And there's a word for that, a word that has a certain resonance within Judaism. It's called idolatry. Right? The worship of anything other than God is idolatry. If you worship the self, if you lack humility, then you're worshiping yourself. That's not just bad form, it's not just bad manners. It's a fundamental violation of what Judaism is all about. In addition, there is a kind of social utility that goes with humility. Right? And that is that there is a link, just like there's a link between overcoming arrogance and having order, so too there is a link between humility and mercy. Okay, mercy, we forgive ourselves for our failings, but we recognize our failings. It's that combination that's the kind of magical combination, right? One of our problems in society, and you see it with every time one of these politicians gets caught with their zipper down, right, which seems to be
a lot,
okay? I mean, I don't know. Is there anybody in Trenton? You know, who knows what these guys are doing, you know? That they demand self-acceptance, okay? They demand self-acceptance, but only with the illusion that everything is okay. All right? Everything's okay, so of course you should accept me. I mean, what? I wrote something on Facebook. Come on! You know? Oh, yeah, okay. I betrayed my wife. I betrayed my family. I betrayed my office. I betrayed my oath. I betrayed all this. But come on! You know, I feel conflicted about it, okay? You know, Spinoza said that self-esteem is the highest thing that we could hope for. It's not this like low thing, like you could be the biggest low light, you know, you could be Tony Soprano, but you got to have your self-esteem, okay? No, self-esteem is something that you end with, not that you start with. And you get there not by simply accepting everything that you do as if it's okay, but you get there, the root to it, is by recognizing precisely what isn't okay. You can forgive yourself for it, but you still have to recognize it for the failure that it is and approach it that way as a failure that needs to be addressed. Immanuel Kant wrote that true humility is, and I'm quoting, the consciousness and feeling of the insignificance of one's moral worth in comparison with the law. Right. The insignificance of one's moral worth in comparison with the law. The idea that the law, the mandate, right, is so much bigger than I am, and something to which I must, pardon the word, submit. That's true humility. How common is that in our society? Not very. Not very. And, you know, this is a really perfect, you know, place to point out that those that substitute compulsive ritual behavior for common decency are no further advanced in this regard than anybody else is. You know, I don't care how glot your meat is, okay? That doesn't cut it when it comes to this, okay? On the other hand, they aren't the only ones, you know, who have these kinds of pretensions, because we have our pretensions as well. We all think that we're wonderful, you know, and that what we're doing is perfectly okay. And how should we be living our lives? Well, the way I am. You know, one of my congregants in Benton Harbor, Michigan said, Rabbi, anybody less religious than I am is reform, and anybody more religious is a fanatic. You know, it's good to know. He was the dividing line. You know, he was the one. He was like the continental divide right there. You know, he's right at the top of the ridge. He's the one that okay, you know, really? You know, it is to show how perverse our lack of humility is. And humility, of course, is a refusal to recognize authority. The authority of the law and the authority of God to give that law. Right? To show how perverse it is, give some thought to the fact that the word human comes from humus, earth, dirt. Right? And that is the root of the word humility as well. So, in other words, when we deny our humility, we are simultaneously denying our own humanity. And this is paralleled within Judaism, because Adam, the first man, the first human, right, is taken from Adama, is taken from the ground. Right? The same issues apply. That humility is intended to be essential to our humanity, integral to our humanity. When you don't have the humility, you are betraying the very meaning of what it is to be human. All right. Now, Kant wrote, and I'm quoting, "Whoever makes himself a worm cannot complain when he is then trampled underfoot." So he is attacking sort of false modesty. All right. You know the joke about the rabbi, the cantor, and the shamus on the high holidays? That the rabbi gets up and he says, "Oh God, I stand before you on this holy day. Who am I to stand before you on this holy day? I am nothing." And the cantor says, "Oh Lord, you know, I'm supposed to daven on behalf of the congregation, but who am I to daven before you? I'm nothing." And the shamus gets up and says, "Oh Lord, I don't even know what to do. I don't have any of this. I'm nothing." And the cantor looks at the rabbi and goes, "Look who says he's nothing." All right, so whoever makes himself a worm cannot complain when he is then trampled underfoot, says Kant. But whoever would make himself a statue cannot complain when he is suspected of being hard-hearted or of assuming a pose. Better the sublime beggar who washes the sinner's feet. One of the amazing characteristics of this kind of humility and this kind of recognition of authority is the link that it has between humility and charity, humility and generosity. You know, separated by over 1,000 years, Descartes wrote, "The most generous people are usually also the most humble." And St. Augustine, 1,500 years earlier, "Wherever there is humility, there is also charity." Okay, and this is actually borne out statistically, that what we definitely know is that as people earn more money, and the cutoff point is about $75,000 a year, as you go above that amount, the percentage that you give to charity decreases. So that poorer people are far more charitable, proportionately speaking, than wealthier people. And this is like a little high holiday sermon in preview, but there's a whole bunch of immoral behavior that goes with being wealthy. Okay. Because it's linked to a sense of privilege, and the privilege is linked to a sense of arrogance, because the arrogance is linked to a sense of a lack of humility, and the lack of humility is linked to a refusal to recognize that there is any kind of authority. All right. Honesty and humility are sisters. They come together. You love the truth, or you love yourself. And one of the interesting things is that when you look at Greek literature, which is so much at the foundation of Western civilization, the concept of humility rarely appears. You know, the Greek guy, the Greeks who are running around, you know, with their swords and spears and, you know, killing this one and stripping that one, it's like, you know, that's not really a message of humility that gets carried over. Okay. Our God, whether we believe in God or not, just the image of God as we have it in Western civilizations, gives us an invaluable lesson in humility. The ancients defined themselves as mortal, and they felt that death alone was the only thing that distinguished them from the gods. Like when you look at what Zeus does, all right, he does the same thing that human beings do. He just can keep on doing it. Okay, but other than that, there's no real substantive quality. There's no really sort of eerie difference between Zeus and Achilles or Hercules or any other human or Odysseus. All right. But we have a different perspective. All right. We know that even if we could live forever, we still wouldn't be God. You know, the tree of life is not the same as the tree of knowledge. Okay. Now, some could say that when you look at how pathetic human beings are, you know, when you look at all of our failures, you know, it almost becomes an argument for atheism. You know, if you say, oh, well, we are created in the image of God, hey, yeah, this is, what kind of God is this that would create us? You know, and when you look at the craziness out in the world, you know, you got to say to yourself, what? You know, do you really think God, this is what God had in mind? And so, our humility, you know, our honest self-appraisal could lead perversely to a denial of divine authority precisely because we are so worm-like, you know, we are worse, right? You don't have worms doing what Boko Haram is doing. But there is a beautiful midrash that speaks to this. And it's sort of with this I'll conclude. A beautiful midrash that says that everybody should walk around with two little slips of paper in their pockets. Okay? In one pocket, the slip of paper should say, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. You're nothing. Right. And in the other slip of paper, it should say, the entire world was created for me, for my benefit. And you should walk around with those two slips of paper. And this is the glory of Judaism, is its willingness to take these two entirely contradictory attitudes and say that we should be, you know, as much as gigantic as the dichotomy is between those two attitudes, that we should be able to live, you know, in the tension between those. Yeah, on the one hand, we are miserable and we are nothing and we are, you know, worm-like and pathetic and all the rest of it. And on the other hand, we are glorious and created in the image of God. And our job, we are the servants of the Holy One, blessed be He. Right. And that is, on the one hand, well, we're the servants, so we're down here and He's up there. On the other hand, we are the servants of the Holy One, blessed be He. We have a role in life. We have a position in life that matters. And so humility then, and the role, the link between humility and authority, then becomes this very odd sort of shimmering thing, because on the one hand, yeah, we're nothing, but we're His nothing, right? And that puts us in a unique situation. And I want to give you an example of that, a couple of them actually that show up in our prayer book. So, if you look at page 12. Now, this is a prayer that is said way early in the service. We don't actually formally say this here as part of our davening. You know, people skip it a lot. But, you know, if you're davening at home, you know, you would say this prayer. And it's the bottom half of the of page 13. Okay. Ribon kol ha'olamim, Master of all worlds, not upon our merit do we rely in our supplication, but upon Your limitless love. What are we? What is our life? What is our piety? What is our righteousness? What is our attainment, our power, our might? What can we say, Lord our God and God of our ancestors, compared to You, all the mighty are nothing, the famous non-existent, the wise lack wisdom, the clever lack reason. For most of their actions are meaningless, the days of their lives emptiness. Human preeminence over beasts is an illusion when all is seen as futility. How's that for a perk me up in the morning? Okay, all right. So, yeah, we're all a bunch of worms. You know, we're all pathetic. Everything is terrible. What are we even doing here? It's all meaningless. Give up. Right. Remember Desiderata, from way back when, you know, all these wonderful things. And then there was another one, the deteriorata was the parody. And then the last words are, you know, the whole universe is meaningless. Give up. I'll have to print that out for you. But if you Google deteriorata, you'll see it. It's pretty funny. Okay, so everything, human preeminence over beasts is an illusion when all is seen as futility. But, we are your people, partners to your covenant, descendants of your beloved Abraham. All right? We are the heirs of Isaac. We are your firstborn people. Therefore, it is our duty to thank you and praise you, to glorify and sanctify your name. How good is our portion, how pleasant our lot, how beautiful our heritage, how blessed are we that twice each day, morning and evening, we are privileged to declare, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Praised be God's glorious sovereignty throughout all time. Okay. Now, it is an utterly amazing statement. Yeah. From one existential point of view, we are nothing. I mean, I got bad news, but we're all going to die. Okay? I'm reminded, there's this wonderful Far Side cartoon, you know, Gary Larson Far Side cartoon, and it's a dinosaur convention, and the president of the Stegosaurus, he's up there, and he says, okay, we got climate change going on, an asteroid is approaching the Earth, and none of us have a brain bigger than a pea. Okay? So that's where we are, guys. Bad news, we're all going to die. Okay? That's over here. That's this pocket. Okay. But how glorious is our life that we have a chance to declare, to participate in a relationship with the authority that created the world. That's what gives meaning to our lives. That's why our lives are not hevel. That's why our lives are not nothingness. How do they describe it? Vanity, nothingness. What do they say? That our lives are not futility. Right? Precisely when we see ourselves not as ourselves, because ourselves doesn't mean anything, but ourselves in relationship to the divine means everything. Okay, so guys, I'll stop there. If you have any questions. Yes.
Know the truth. Recognize who's truth.
Ah, okay. So who's truth? All right. mine. All right. just kidding. All right.
Other pocket.
All right. All right. Other pocket. Right. Let me go to that pocket. Okay. First of all, we have a tradition that asserts a wisdom greater than any of ours. Okay, so in terms of our ability to discern truth, one thing that we can do that requires a certain humility is to rely on the wisdom of tradition. Okay, so that certainly is part of it. We need to compare apples and apples and not apples and oranges. If it were only you and me in the room, it's a 50-50 basically. Okay? But it's when you and me and Torah in the room, that shifts the scale. Okay? There's the classic Southern expression, ain't none of us smart as all of us. All right? And all of us collectively can be assumed to come up with greater wisdom than any one of us individually. And if that's true right now, bring 4,000 years of wisdom into the mix. You know, that vast array of rabbis and philosophers and theologians who spent their lives thinking about the big questions. I think that that's a pretty reliable truth. Right. Number one. And number two, you got to be somebody really special to say, well, I don't care about any of that because what I think is, you know, you can do it if you want to, but you better be real good if you're prepared to do that. And I, you know, when I look around, I don't see people that good. Okay. It's rare that I will see somebody who's thoughts are so transcendent, so deep, that they trump everything that came before. That's asking an awful lot. Now, that's not to say that somebody can come, you know, can't come up with a good idea. All right, but broadly speaking, about the way you conduct your entire life, our tradition's been thinking about that question. You know, because remember, for us, how we conduct our lives is a divinely related question. That's what mitzvot are all about. So there were generation after generation after generation of people who thought that that was like the essential question to the, around which all else, you know, it's not how old the universe is, it's how do I do my mitzvot? That was the essential question. So relying on that truth, I think, is a pretty reasonable thing to do. Now, the link between truth and subjectivity, that's a tougher question than the link between, a much tougher question than the link between morality and subjectivity. Okay? It's one thing to say, you know, oh, well, you think it's okay to murder 6 million Jews, but I don't. Okay? That's an argument that's easily, you know, sort of, it's easy to dismiss that argument. But how and when God spoke to whom, that's a much, much trickier thing. You know, it's much easier to have two legitimately different opinions about that than it is to have two differently legitimate opinions about, you know, what you know, what you are allowed to do and not allowed to do from a moral perspective. Okay? The last thing I would say about that is that Niels Bohr, the great Danish Jewish scientist, all right, he was the guy that more or less invented the model of the atom that, you know, sort of looks like a miniature solar system with the you know, the nucleus and then the electrons spinning around, which isn't exactly the way it works, but, you know, that was the model for a long time. He once made the comment that the opposite of a truth is a falsehood, but the opposite of a great truth can sometimes be another great truth. And, you know, applying that to the world of, you know, the ethnosphere, you know, moving out of, you know, subatomic physics and moving it into culture, all right, I would not want to see a sort of debate between, you know, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and Hinduism and Buddhism, you know, about which one was right. You know, I really think that's going to be a useless discussion, all right? You know, unless you come from another planet and are making a decision about which one you want to do, you know, and assuming you didn't have one on your own planet, all right, that, you know, everybody has their tradition and their culture that's shaped around their tradition, and that's like the ballpark in which they ought to be playing. And when I say that they ought to be playing, it's not because it's, you know, sort of mandated that it ought to be that way, but it just seems like the most utilitarian thing to do is to stick with your own, because you'll have a deeper you have a head start, you'll have a deeper understanding, a more, you know, solid grasp of, you know, where you are and where this all comes from. All right, now you could theoretically do, I mean, there are people all the time, you know, they go to Nepal, you know, they do whatever, right? It's not that they're not learning something when they do that. Right. They are, and they can be learning some very, very deep things. But, you know, there is the classic story, beautiful story about the guy in Eastern Europe who has a dream that if only he goes to Prague and goes and starts digging under this, you know, phenomenal bridge, I forget what it's called, but this glorious bridge in Prague, that he'll find a treasure there. So he goes down to Prague, and he starts digging there, and a soldier or a policeman sees him there and goes, "What are you doing?" And he explains that, "I had this dream that if I came here and I dug underneath this bridge, that I'd find a great treasure." And the soldier says, "Yeah, that's funny, because last night I had a dream that I was going to meet this little Jewish guy, and that if I went someplace in Poland, I would, you know, and started digging under his bed, that I would find a great treasure there." So the Jew goes back, and he digs under his own bed, and he finds the treasure. You know, so yeah, you probably could find a treasure in Prague too, but all you have to do is dig under your own bed, you'll find one. Other comments?
Yeah. So the dangerous discussion about which religion is better.
Which religion is better? I'm not sure if there are any way to come up with a criteria by which you can decide that.
It's dangerous.
It's dangerous. I think it's unworkable.
Sure.
I mean, Yeah, sure. Mine's better, you know, but it's you're going to run out of something to say soon thereafter, okay? It leads into a world of subjectivity. When you have religion after religion after religion telling you that they are the ones that receive the ultimate revelation, you know, where do you go from there? When God spoke to me and said, there's no way to have an argument about that. You know, I mean, you can kill somebody, but other than that, there's no way to end that argument. God spoke to you? Well, yeah, God spoke to me too. God spoke to my tradition. Yeah. God spoke to my tradition after he spoke to your tradition. I said, yeah, well, you know, you're a social climber. You know, nothing reasonable can be said there. I mean, to the point where Rav Soloveitchik, you know, the Rav, you know, the great leader of modern Orthodoxy, he blanket, I'm not sure if condemned is the right word, but certainly did not condone interfaith dialogue. He said, you know, you can only have interfaith meetings about sort of practical considerations like fighting anti-Semitism or something, but that he saw absolutely no utility in having an interfaith dialogue where people are talking about their idea of the soul or their idea of creation or their view of God or anything else. He just said, you know, we come from conceptually different worlds, different vocabulary, the words don't mean the same thing. You know, what grace means to a Christian is very different from what grace means to a Jew. What charity means to a Christian is very different from what charity means to a Jew. And so, that kind of interfaith dialogue is just like a useless exercise. I don't share that opinion. Forgive me. I mean, who am I to compare myself to the Rav? But you know, in no way do I mean to do that. He was truly a genius. But I think that on this one, I think that he was, a little bit blinded. I think that much can be learned about our own tradition by studying and contrasting with others.
But
you know, deep in insight. But mine's better than yours. I those words really don't make any sense. You know, by what possible criteria could you decide that? Who is the outside judge that sets up the terms for which this one or that one is better? I'll conclude with there's a classic joke about a Protestant and a Catholic clergy in Ireland traveling in a train, and they have a very nice conversation together, and everything is wonderful. And they get off the train, and the Protestant minister says, "Well, now, each one of us will, go back to our own parishes and do God's work." And the Roman Catholic priest says, "Yes, you in your way, and I in His way." Okay, guys, let's go and get ourselves some cheesecake there.
Sherman Vergara.